there, and welcome to the podcast that doesn't just get its guests to talk about food, it feeds them too, and feeds them properly. Thank you so much for joining me. Today, I lunch with a comedian, singer, actor, presenter, and impressionist who really made his name in the much-loved sitcom Gavin and Stacey alongside his friend from school days, Ruth Jones. He presents the long-running panel show Would I Lie to You, and he plays the companion to Steve Coogan's stand-in restaurant critic for The Observer in 4 series of The Trip. But today, oh lucky man, he gets to eat with the real Observer restaurant critic. He reveals what it's like getting a private performance from Shirley Bassey, his adventures as a voiceover artist, and how Ronnie Corbett left messages on his answer phone. It is, of course, the multi-talented Rob Brydon.
And we go, wow, you know, with Shirley Bassey, it's amazing. She's gone for about 5 minutes. She comes back, right? She flung open the curtain and she went, the minute you walked in the joint. And she did about a verse and a chorus. And she walked around the table, draping her hands. And David and I were looking at each other going, oh my God.
There is something lovely and quite old school about my guest, Rob Brydon, today. So I thought I'd kind of match him to something a bit old school, and that is Signor Sassi, which is a brilliant Italian restaurant tucked away on a little alleyway not far from Harrods, not far from Hyde Park, where they do things the way Italian restaurants used to do and here still do. And I think Rob's going to like this. Let's go inside.
Hello.
Come on in.
How are you? Nice to see you.
Good to see you. Lovely to see you.
Oh, you've got lovely warm hands.
Have I got lovely warm hands?
Oh, let's stay there for a minute. Oh.
I will. Are you cold?
You're freezing. Yeah, I didn't dress correctly.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Rob, right at the beginning of the trip, Steve Coogan's voice is on a voice message to you, and he says, do you want to come with me on this journey? Because I've been asked to stand in for the restaurant critic of The Observer, which of course I am. So my first question is, how does it feel to finally actually get to eat with the real restaurant critic of The Observer?
It's a thrill. I mean, what human could react in any other way? They were big shoes to fill, Jay. And I don't mean just in a sort of a hereditary genetic disposition of the foot. I mean in a status and standing. Although those foot concerns, have they cleared up?
Not entirely.
No.
And I've had surgery a couple of times.
I'm told they never will entirely. You learn to live with them. You'll die with it then,
yes,
rather than of it.
The large shoes that I have to fill are a part of me now.
And
I hope Steve appreciated it.
And you know what they say about big feet, big socks?
At the point which we were talking just a couple of days ago, on The Masked Singer.
I know where you're going.
Yeah, you know where I'm going. The traffic cone was revealed to be one Aled Jones.
Mm.
And in the run-up, there was a lot of people who were suggesting it was you.
I think it must be the Welshness of his voice, but I could tell it was Aled.
You sing?
Yes.
When you'd worked out that it was Aled Jones, was it a bit of a thrill that people were thinking it was you?
My own kids would say to me, is it you, Dad? I had said to them, well, I said, look, when you do The Masked Singer, you're not allowed. You have to say it. And they go, oh, Dad. And I say, okay, no, it's not me. But they wouldn't believe that, you see. My older kids, who are now 27, 25 and 22, they have all been to various things of mine over the years. And once my eldest girl came to a recording of Would I Lie to You, and I've been doing it for years.
Season 426.
It is now, 427. Right, and I think she arrived and she said, all right, is this the one you host? And then another time my son came out to Pinewood to watch it. And when he got to the gate, there was a bit of hassle, you know. They weren't going to let him in. And he came out with the immortal line, the host is my father. Which has kind of a biblical,
it does have a biblical
quality,
yes,
to it.
It really does.
It's not an entitled thing or nothing like that. It was just him saying, oh, well, no, it's sort of been arranged. And another one, like, my dad works on it, or my dad is the host. The host is my father.
It does have a kind of Methodist,
yeah,
sound from, yeah, the valleys. It really does.
I love that.
Rob, this is Paolo who will be serving us today.
Paolo, lovely to meet you.
Lovely to meet you. I hope you enjoy Signor Sassi.
Now, listen, we're at Signor Sassi, Italian restaurant. I need to point out something to you. If you look at the antipasti, Parma ham and melon.
Lovely.
Isn't that part of what you once said would be your last meal?
Yeah, but you have to understand, as I'm sure you know,
You mean you were making it up?
When you get asked these questions, there's which I've been asked so many times, there is a big part of you that goes, oh, I don't know. I'll say something.
All right, well, choose what you like. It's a big menu there. I'm not even going to show you where the scallops are.
Well, yeah, scallops I had almost every time on the trip. I like scallops. I love parma ham and melon. I'm not feeling especially adventurous, so maybe I will go for... Yeah, I'm going to have the parma ham and melon.
Are you?
Yeah, I am.
I'll start with the carpaccio.
Raw beef carpaccio, very nice.
Yeah. And can I then have the gamberoni diavola? And I'll have some zucchini fritti, please.
Oh, look at the way you've ordered. That's an alpha male ordering there. And here comes the beta, or the gamma. For the main, seafood risotto, please. Yes, yes.
Nice.
And I'll have some... Well, if we both have zucchini, what's it? Is that too much, do you think?
No, they're really great, and I don't want you having any of mine.
Okay, thank you.
Do you want any wine, or are you all right?
I shouldn't. I've got this, you know, I know it'd be more fun for you if I did.
Well, yeah, the whole intention was to get you completely wrapped
up. Well, I'll tell you what I would have at lunchtime normally, yeah, if I'm going out. I would have, it's quite camp, but I like that. I'd have a Kia Royale.
Oh, it's great.
I love a Kia Royale at lunch.
A little bit of cassis. It's got to be a blush. Sometimes you ask someone to make it and they swamp it with the cassis. I think it should just be on the edge.
Oh, I agree with that. And what determines whether they bring you a still wine as opposed to fizzy? Is there something in the title? Because that happens sometimes.
Well, it's just a Kia.
And I'm disappointed.
So a Kia Royale is with champagne.
Is that right?
And just a Kia is without.
Oh, do you know what? Sometimes I've asked for a Kia thinking that I'm being casual and I'm so familiar with it.
No, you've asked for a specific name.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's the difference.
I go, what the hell is this?
One of the things I thought was great about Signor Sassi, I don't know if you saw on the way up, was there's lots of photographs on the wall of that classic showbiz.
I love that.
You do love it,
yes,
do you? Where does that come from?
When I was growing up, if you went to a restaurant, if there were pictures of anyone, Frank Bruno would be there.
He's there.
Yeah, and Russ Abbott. Is this twinned with San Carlo?
Yes.
Great, okay. So whenever I'm in Manchester, which isn't that often, but, you know, if I'm touring, I'll always do Manchester, sometimes telly, I'll try and go to San Carlo. And the walls there are just festooned with pictures.
Are you on them?
I think they took my picture the last time I was there, but I might be imagining that. It's kind of awkward when you're there.
You wanted to go, and with mine?
I know, because they make a fuss of you,
yeah,
you know, and sometimes some of the other diners will come over to your table and want to say hello to you and have a picture with you, and then you are kind of aware that because there are thousands, I mean, everybody from Pavarotti to, I don't know, someone who's been on some dreadful low-rent show, right? So you'd think, well, I could fit in somewhere there, couldn't I, in that spectrum? So there is a slight sort of, yeah. So I think they did take my photo, but I'm not sure. I don't know on whether they put it up.
And you can't ask.
No, of course not,
no. You can't ask. When you were a kid growing up in Port Talbot, was that, we're of a very similar age, I think, that kind of Saturday night variety thing,
yes,
on TV, was that something that you were drawn to as a kid?
Yes. I liked The Generation Game. You know, The Two Ronnies in their own way was a variety show.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I remember, I mean, his name will come up at some point, Steve Coogan. So I remember Steve telling me that he didn't go to see Grease. No, neither did I. I didn't go because I thought it looked a bit rough. Honestly.
You thought, not for the likes of me?
Honestly. Or if not...
Is that because you've just seen the shot of Olivia Newton-John having been stitched into her black trousers?
No, I don't know what it was. I had no enthusiasm to see it. He didn't see it, right? Because, his words, I knew it was for the masses. Right? Now, at that age, I didn't know. I had no concept of this idea of there being such a thing as the masses. And I wouldn't have that concept for many years. I mean, probably my 20s or, good God, maybe even later.
Did you see yourself as having a role in that kind of world? Was that the ambition?
I wasn't aware of anything other than the mainstream. Other than saying that I like, in comedy, I'm kind of proud to say that I liked people that perhaps had a bit of edge to them. I mean,
like who?
Well, Barry Humphries. Okay, now, Barry became mainstream Saturday night, but my God, within that thing, he was as sharp as any humorist or satirist.
He did things that were so close to the edge.
Yes.
And sometimes well over it.
Yeah. Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, although not the Derek and Clive stuff.
Peter Cook and Dudley Moore were quite a mainstream comedy act, but they also had this alter ego.
Well, they were a mainstream act, but they were sharp as hell. I mean, this term mainstream tends to have a pejorative sort of negative side to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm having that.
While you've been away, we've been talking, and are you going to have one as well?
Yes.
Could we have two Kia Royales, please?
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
When you met Ruth, and you were at secondary school together, weren't you?
Yes.
Was she immediately someone you thought, she's like me?
Yeah, my memory of it is that she was part of not the drama society, there wasn't that, but we had a brilliant young drama teacher called Roger Bunnell, and put on shows. He put in a big musical each year, so we did West Side Story, which I got a tiny, it was all cast, but I managed to be one of the jets. I had one line, which was, it hurts. Kia Royales arrived.
There you go. Was Ruth Jones getting bigger parts than you in these shows?
Sit, how dare you, Jay? Why would you make such an assumption? In Guys and Dolls, I was Sky, and she was Miss Adelaide. So there are four leads in Guys and Dolls. Sky and Sarah, Adelaide and Nathan, two couples. So there we are.
Is there a particular bond between two people who started? There's the two of you from, from one secondary school.
Oh yeah, it does give us a hell of a bond, and it's quite emotional because, I've known her for bloody donkey's years.
You're about to do another series.
We've done a one-off kind of playhouse thing.
Gaynor and Ray.
Yes, yeah.
Which is, as I understand it, you're only allowed to be in series which have a male and a female name in the title. Is that right?
Strange, isn't it?
Mariner Jeff, Cameron and Stacey, Gaynor and Ray.
Was there another one as well? Have I done?
Let's pretend
else?
There is.
There was an animation I did years ago called Bob and Margaret. Years ago, so there's another one. Oh, and I did a thing recently with Dawn French called Roald and Beatrix. I do think I have more than my fair share of engendered titles. Yeah.
It's a relationship that's still going on professionally.
Yeah. The best thing we ever did together in terms of enjoyment was the record we made for Comic Relief. We did this version of Islands in the Stream, which we'd sung in the show. And for Comic Relief, they got Tom Jones on it. And we went to Las Vegas to film the video. That was incredible to because I also factored jet lag into it, which heightens everything. So we fly in and we're filming this thing. And Ruth and I just could not believe it. Because Tom Jones is a big deal wherever you are, but especially if you grew up in Wales.
Where were you put up in Vegas?
We stayed at Planet Hollywood. Dreadful.
Was
it? I've always said there's a lot of hotels that are great if you're in the process of getting off with someone, basically, right?
Getting off.
But if you're not doing
that's a 1979.
No, yeah, well,
did you get off with it?
Well, you know what I mean, though,
yeah.
Right?
Okay.
But then all the dark furniture and everything is kind of, ooh. But if you're just going about your business, you don't really want it. The opposite of that, there's a hotel in Los Angeles called the Mondrian.
Oh, yeah.
Which I've stayed at, I mean, yonks ago. The rooms are all light. Everything is white. And I remember talking to Reese Evans about it. And he said, I stayed there. Bloody hell. He said, it's like being in an asylum. He goes, I want to see furniture.
Have you met Tom before you did the song?
Yeah, I'd liked him for years, long before his renaissance, long before he went on Jonathan Ross and suddenly he was cool again and he did Kiss. I'd liked him, I think, as long as I can remember, really.
Was your attraction to him as a performer out of the fact he was another Welsh guy?
Yeah, that's right. It certainly helps that we've got lots of them, We've got Richard Burton, Anthony Hopkins, Shirley Bassey. When I was
growing
up... Can
you do, Shirley? Go on.
Well, given the chance. David Walliams, who's a friend of mine, did a show for the BBC, a big special with her. And one night I was going out with David to see, I think we were going to see Catherine Tate live. He said, I'm having a meeting with Shirley at the Ritz, so why don't you come and see us there? Well, it just so happened the night before I had hosted, I think it was the Evening Standard Film Awards, and she'd been in the audience. And I'd met her once or twice before. So I arrived at the Ritz and got taken through to
I don't know what it was, maybe a big restaurant that wasn't being used or a ballroom or something. And they were sat off in a curtained area, so you couldn't see who was in there. So I went in and there she was with David and the producers and Shirley's assistant. And she said, oh, I don't know. I said, oh, you were so good last night. You were so funny. Which, of course, David was furious about. But so I said, oh, thank you, Shirley. Thanks very much. So we sit down and they're talking about the show. And well, I wonder, you know, that bit, maybe what I should do is and all this stuff. And then at one point she says, right, I got to go to the little girl's room or whatever. So she gets up to go. And we go, wow, you know, we're Shirley Bassey. It's amazing. She's gone for about 5 minutes. She comes back, right? And this is, I'm not exaggerating. She flung open the curtain and she went, the minute you walked in the joint. And she started, she did about a verse and a chorus. And she walked around the table, draping her hands. And David and I were looking at each other going, oh my God, it was sublime. So if you ever do get the chance to meet Dame Shirley Bassey, she won't disappoint.
Well, that's what I want to hear. Thank you.
That was great. Thank you very much. Love.
Hello, it's Ollie here. I'm the executive producer on Out to Lunch. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, one of the relationships I'm proudest of in my life is with my daughters. They're not quite the age to go for fancy lunches with celebs yet, but we do enjoy our family dinners together in relative harmony. You know, give us time, that they are still quite young. But this takes work, and it's a mistake to think that relationships have to be easy to be right. The best relationships come out of learning to live with each other and keeping our sense of humour, even when food is spilt all over the table or dinner's not to everyone's liking. It can be really tricky, but therapy can help you with those skills. You can work through parenting challenges, explore seeing eye to eye as a couple, and work through your relationship with yourself too. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's flexible and you can switch therapists at any time, as that's a relationship that needs to be the right fit too. Become your own soulmate, whether you're looking for one or not. Visit betterhelp.com/outtolunch today and get 10% off your first month.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Oh, I am the risotto, thank you.
I am the risotto.
I am the risotto, as John Lennon once said. Oh, thank you. Thanks very much.
And I have the prawns with garlic and chilli.
You are the prawns.
I am the prawns.
Thank you.
Zucchini fritti.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad we got two, because I don't think one of these would have done for us.
No, no.
At what point did you realise you had the ability to imitate voices?
As long as I can remember. You know, when I was a kid, the thing I always say, some people can do keepy-uppies, can't they, with a ball. I could never do that. But I could do Kermit the Frog.
You're known for doing Tony Hopkins, for Tom Jones.
Mm-hmm.
Does a Welsh accent give you if they're Welsh, does it give you a starting point?
Oh, yes, of course, yes, because you understand it, yeah.
And Ronnie Corbett's Celtic fringe.
Well, it's a very sort of posh Edinburgh sort of accent, you know, with his vowels were wonderful. And as he got older, his voice became this beautiful, rich... I've got answerful messages from him still. He says, Rob, it's Ronnie calling. And he was on this bright, crisp winter's morning. And it's deeper than that. It's terrific, yeah. So for me, and I always have to say, I do a handful of impressions. I do them again and again and again. But I'm not a John Coleshaw or somebody like that who can do zillions, right? I can't. I have my little group, and they're always people I like. I don't use them to spear people. I use them to elevate people, to celebrate people.
At 20, you left drama school because you pretty much landed a gig on radio.
That's right.
And you did it. You're on the radio for six
mm-hmm,
years.
Mm-hmm.
6 years in your 20s is a very, very long time.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Did you assume that that was your life?
When I was a kid, I was really interested in radio, actually. And I I found the idea of being a disc jockey on the radio, in those days it would have been Radio 1, I found it very appealing, quite sexy in the sense of it being exciting. And I remember I sent off for a book called How to Be a DJ. Remember in those days, now you'd look it up on the internet, but in those days you used to send a stamped addressed envelope, right? I'd see pictures of DJs at Radio 1 sitting in front of those two decks and having cartridge machines for the, what are they called, jingles.
Yeah.
And I thought it just really appealed to me.
Did you get to that point where you were driving your own desk?
Yes.
Do you think you could still do it?
I have. When I did, I've sat in on Radio 2 for a few people. I've sat in for Steve Wright. I've sat in for Ken Bruce. I think I drove the desk for one of them. I can't remember now.
When did that go from, would you like to do a commercial voiceover? Which eventually became your bread and butter. Mm.
So I'm on the radio, doing a lot on the radio. Eventually get let go of from the station.
When you say let go, they sacked you.
This is very tasty, by the way.
I have to say, my prawns are very good as well.
This is I mean, I wish I wasn't talking quite so much, but...
No, I'm sorry, the reason you're here.
I know. What can you do?
What can you do, yeah.
A new editor came in. So you know about this, right? New editor. They want new things, and they've got to make space. So in came this new editor, lovely woman called Megan, and who said, look, sorry, but, you know, it's not worked out. So, but I still had a few shows left. I was doing a phone-in, and there was a woman on the phone, I think from Merthyr, going, hey, Rob, how are you? I was going, hey, how are you doing? Will you play Sweet Caroline by Neil Diamond? Yes, of course I will. And then, and I go, what's that? She goes, oh, sorry, Megan, be quiet. And I said on air, Megan, we've got a bitch called Megan here. She's quite unlike me.
Were you quite cross? Did you get a memo from the BBC on headed paper?
I honestly can't remember whether or not I did. I don't know. I suspect far more likely no one was listening.
Eventually you're into voiceovers.
Oh, yes.
And you, you know, two or three a day was not unusual, sometimes mm-hmm. four or five. I have to ask you, I believe one of the things you did was the voiceover for a video on what to expect when you go for your colonoscopy.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
As a man of a certain age, has that proved useful information in time?
It's always good to know. The more knowledge is power, Jay, is what I say. Yeah, I did. This is years ago. I had to say something like, the probe will then be inserted into your... Da, 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 da. And I think it was something like, at this point, you may pass wind. This is perfectly normal. Or something like that. And it was just my...
It's a very comforting voice.
Yeah, I got a nice voice. You know, it's been... Thank God. I mean, my God. You know, your voice is a freak of nature, isn't it? It's just chance. If I think about my life and my career, my voice has been my greatest asset. You know, more than wit. Because... You don't need wit to say, bounty, taste the exotic.
Did you do bounty?
Oh, I did everything. I did that. I did have a break, have a Kit Kat. I did that. I did, you know when you've been tangoed. I did Gaviscon Cool. What a feeling. I did crunchy nut cornflakes. Well, they are ludicrously tasty. I did Sainsbury's. Try something different.
Can I just say that all this free advertising, if any of these companies are now listening to this podcast and want to sponsor us, please get in touch.
No, or if they just feel a moral obligation to send you some money.
Yes, that would be great. By the time, do we call it your break? Mm-hmm. About 2000, you're 35.
Right. Yeah, very much.
Marin and Jeff
mm-hmm.
comes along. Had you thought that wasn't going to happen?
Yes, right at the end, right before it did. And leading up to that, I was thinking, okay, maybe I'm going to be a voiceover guy and I'll get a job on Three Counties Radio. I knew I could always do that.
Were you resigned to it? Or were you unhappy about it?
I was kind of resigned to it, I was, you know, because it's not a bad life.
No, sure.
We were going off on skiing holidays, nice car, nice house, you know, it was fine, nice life. And then one agent, and I can't remember who it was, got me seen for Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels.
The Guy Ritchie film.
That's right. Big hit. I went and had my meeting with him to play this crappy role of the traffic warden. He's just a guy, anybody could have done it, right? So I'm there. So I went and did that. And then this is great. This is what you dream of as an actor. I remember I bumped into Stephen Moyer, the actor, on Wardour Street. We'd done a hat trick drama together. I was a crappy part playing a policeman this time who had to say to Prunella Scales, is this your car? I mean, rubbish. And Stephen said, hey, you know that film you're in? Because I don't think Stephen's in it. Unless I'm forgetting. He said, you know that film you're in, that Lockstock thing? There's a lot of talk about. Apparently, Tom Cruise
held a screening of it in Hollywood. Now, in those days, I didn't realise that's what actors do. These screenings happen all the time. Nonetheless, sure, it's not, it's a good thing, you know. I said, oh, really? And then the next thing I remember is I'm walking along the upper, we lived in East Sheen then, walking along the Upper Richmond Road, and I used to buy Empire. I used to love film. I used to love it.
Empire was a great
Empire
magazine.
Empire magazine, yeah. I used to, oh my God, film, film, film. And I opened it and they reviewed it, right? And they loved it. And they mentioned me. And now I've got a tiny part. And they said, their words were, blah-de-blah, blah-de-blah, and an extremely unlucky traffic warden, Robert Bryden. And the canny part of my brain knew that that was leverage. So what I did was I got a nice video camera. I wrote a script to four characters. One of them was Keith Barrett from Marion and Jeff, the other three other things. With my best friend, we went out, we filmed this thing. I then paid an editing facility. I paid a graphics company to, I designed a cover for the VHS. And I called it Robert Bryden, an extremely unlucky traffic warden. And on the back, I put fresh from his breakout performance in Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
And is this the one that Steve saw? So you said Steve Coogan saw this?
Mm-hmm. Because I knew Julia Davis, because we'd been in improv together. The two important people saw it, Steve and Hugo Blick, whom I made Marion and Jeff with, who was working the Beep, and who I'd been at college with. We were never that close, but I had been at college with him. I had some really good fortune, right, which you need.
If we jump forward to the trip, there's a version of a relationship between you and Steve in that. Did it take you a while to get to a point where you were equals, or has that never happened?
Yeah, I did, yeah, because I started as his fan. A fan. I'm still an admirer. I think he's possibly the greatest comic talent in Britain. I would say that. He's not without his faults. I don't know who you would put above Steve Coogan, right? Especially in what he's done with Alan Partridge. I mean, if that was the only thing he'd ever done.
Yeah, the ability to keep a character going and growing and developing over 20-whatever
years.
Yes,
I think that's just because he has evolved, you see. Initially, he was very much a fan meeting, you know, someone that he admires. And you get to know each other. And then we started to work together and...
When the trip was first proposed by Michael Winterbottom, you were resistant.
You always said no, I think, twice, maybe three times, yeah.
And what was it that finally tipped you over the edge to say, oh, sod it, let's do this?
Well, first of all, the thing that put us off it was being ourselves, or a version of ourselves. It seemed indulgent. Also, this the whole improvised thing seemed to have been done to death. I remember Michael saying, well, what we do is we'll be at a different restaurant each week, and it's half an hour. And you and Steve just talk. That does Michael a disservice because there's a lot of structure written and indeed conversations are written as well. Michael does, I think, far more than people realise. But having said that, the bits that people remember tend to be the improvised flights of fancy that we do. So, you know, I remember saying to Michael, 6 half hours? I said, I think you could get one good half hour of us just improvising. But I was underestimating.
Four series later.
I know. Well, I was underestimating our ability, I suppose.
For those of us in the restaurant reviewing business, there are already actually about 10 of us. It's not very many. It was quite striking how real it was.
Really?
Oh, there was a particular moment. I think it's in the first... In fact, I know it's in the first series, where you're sitting there. One of you says, you drive all this way to sit in front of a bowl of orange soup. And then you've got to say something about it. And... that's what you're paid for. Did you eat a load of that food?
Yeah, we had to eat every course 3 times. On that first series, I put on 9 pounds. I'd gone years, whenever I'd eat in a scene, I wouldn't. I'd push it around my plate because I worried about continuity. Because I don't know if people understand, but you shoot a scene from one angle, then you shoot the same scene from another angle. So you need to be in vaguely the same position. So that would involve remembering when you put the fork to your mouth on what line and everything. But then when I did Gavin and Stacey, I found that if you are actually eating in a scene, it adds, it's a psychological trick of the audience, it adds a degree of realism. It's the same as if you're actually driving a car in a scene. Steve was being very, you know...
Moving around the plate.
Yeah, he was. So I put on all this weight at the end of that first one.
The nation, in fact, most of the world, because it's been screened in many places, thanks you for your sacrifice.
Well,
they were very good restaurants as well.
In the first one, we went to the York Arms, where Alan Bennett had been staying the night before, and we knew he was going to be there.
and I'd never met him, although my wife had worked with him.
But you have done him many, many
times. Yes, I adore him. And the crew went on ahead of me and Steve, and when we arrived, it was all, is he still here? One of the guys said, oh, no, he's gone. But he did say, oh, what are you doing? And he said, oh, we're doing this thing with Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon. And he said, oh, give my love to Rob.
You'd never met him, but he...
No, but he'd worked with my wife, so I think that's why. Yeah.
You have said that there was a point when you, I think you were in the ruins of Pompeii.
Yes.
And you were, I think Michael had just given you the subject to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
And you had nothing.
Yeah. Well, that happens, you know. I mean, this improvisation lark is all well and good when the juices are flowing. But you learn, just relax. The best thing you can do is relax. Something will come along. You mustn't panic.
You seem to have quite actively avoided anything edgy. And whether that is a function of what you find funny and entertaining or of personality.
Number one, this comes back to Steve as well. Steve is not afraid of conflict. In fact, I sometimes think he relishes it.
Oh, well, the whole hacked off thing and press intrusion, yes, and level. I mean, he went right into
that. So Steve is very... Steve, and I admire him hugely. He has the courage of his convictions. He will put his head above the parapets. But also, in a creative setting, I think Steve, without putting words in his mouth, believes that a bit of conflict can help the creative process. I don't have an appetite for conflict in almost any area. Now, you talk about edgy. It is possible to be... Thank you very much indeed.
Dessert menu.
Thank you very much. It's possible to be edgy without creating an uproar. You can be edgy, by which I mean in your humour and your wit, it can be sharp, it can have edge, and it can have bite, without causing something that the Daily Mail want to run and the government use to distract from other things, you know.
But do you also have a highly tuned filter for it? For example, when you're doing Would I Lie to You, which I think you're on series 15 now and you've been recording for about 16 years, do you ever stop or take a note and go back to the producer and say, can we cut that? Because that's just going to...
It's more often not the case, but it can be the case, yeah, that at the end of the show, I walk up the stairs to the where the dressing rooms are, and we go, hey, good show, whatever, or, ooh, hard work, or whatever it is you say. You normally say it's a good show. And I'll say, oh, you know that bit where I said something, we lose that, yeah? Well, that's perfectly, you know, I imagine that happens in almost all shows.
There is one analysis of Would I Lie to You, which is that it's basically a detailed analysis of the relationship between three middle-aged men aging visibly in front of us. You're doing a tour at the moment, A Night of Music and Laughter.
Yes.
What does the band play you
the
on?
The band play a strange combination of... it's this kind of a made-up tune. There's a little bit of the Welsh national anthem. There's a hint of that in there. So it goes... And I got Jim Carter.
So we're right in by any means necessary territory.
The Armenian national anthem would have just confused people.
I think it would have done.
The Scottish, I mean, they'd have gone, well, why? I thought
why are they playing the Flower of Scotland?
So, there's a durr, and then Jim Carter kindly recorded a thing where he goes, ladies and gentlemen, it is time. Please put down your mobile phones. You have to say that now. Live in the moment, very important, and welcome Rob Brydon. And they go, hey. And he goes, just that bit. I walk out and I take the applause and I do a silly song about the town that we're in. Although, interestingly, when I did London, I was at the Palladium. Now, it doesn't work there. I go, Cleethorpes, the town that I love. It's just a kind of old school parody. Cleethorpes, I put no town above. The people, the places, the bright smiling faces of Cleethorpes. I love you, Ray. And that's the beginning. And
you do that to London, they're going...
Exactly, it doesn't mean anything. So at the Palladium, we said, the Palladium, the room that I love. And then they have that identity of, for one night and only, yeah, we are the Palladium. It's so interesting that you can't... London doesn't have that identity.
Well, I think it's also that, dare I say it, they're not feeling privileged that you came to see them.
Very much so.
They're
very much
expecting
so.
It.
Yeah.
Your love of music is significant, isn't it? Oh, yeah. And I think the people would be a little surprised to know that you weren't immediately going to do this, that David Walliams pretty much had to tell you to go and do something was risky.
That's right. Always sung school musicals, right? When I was a DJ on the radio, did humorous songs, right? As awful as that sounds, have sung on I'm Sorry, Haven't a Clue, Gavin and Stacey. When I did the Rob Brydon show, I sang with all sorts of people from like Mick Hucknall to Tom Jones to all sorts of people. La-di-da. I guested on my friend Joe Stilgo's thing at the Lyric Hammersmith. I've done a few things with Joe.
Producer in the audience of that show said, why don't you, because this was a cabaret that Joe was doing, you should do something like this. I said, oh, I know, I had been thinking about doing a nice intimate cabaret. I said, well, I'd like to. I said, look, you organise it then. Just you go on and organise it and I'll do it. So the first thing we did was we auditioned 6 musical directors, all of whom were fantastic. But Paul Herbert, who I am with, we just got on really well. And what a talent. Oh, what he's done to my voice with his vocal techniques, astonishing.
What next? That's one of those questions we always have.
We've got someone coming around this afternoon to look at my son's PC because there's a problem with it.
That's important. I mean, are you going to carry on touring? Because it's gone very, very well and people love it.
Yeah, it has.
And I think you enjoy it hugely.
I will indulge myself in saying it's gone well because it was taking a chance. And we touched on this thing. It was me and Walliams. He said... We were on holiday. Well, we hadn't gone away together, but we visited each other while on holiday. And I said, what career advice would we give each other? And his to me was, take more chances. I thought, oh, okay. The other advice he gave me with this show is he came to one of those early ones at Crazy Cox, which seats 90 people. And he said, don't ditch the comedy. Because what I had done in wanting to go, hey, look, I'm going to sing, is most of the comedy had gone. And I went, and it was a stupid thing. And I went, oh, yeah. So that was very good advice. So I thought, oh, yeah, let's like an EQ thing, you know, let's adjust
it. What advice did you give him?
That's still with lawyers.
Is it?
You'd have to ask. When you have him on this, ask him. And that's for him to disclose.
What kind of table manners has he got? Does he eat with his hands or is he...
Oh, no, he's very... My God, I tell you what, nobody eats in restaurants more often than David Walliams, I can assure you.
We have the dessert menu in front of us.
Okay.
And while you have a look at that, I'm going to say, Rob Brydon, thank you very much for letting me take you out to lunch.
Oh, well, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. We're done, are we? We're not going to talk over dessert?
Well, we can.
Well, but look, if you decide that what occurs over pudding is rubbish, then listener, goodbye.
Yeah, perfect. Would you like dessert?
Yeah, why not?
What a hoot. Thank you so much to Rob Brydon. And I can assure you that his photo is going up on the wall of Signor Sassy in Knightsbridge as I speak. Thank you so much to the folks there. And do go to robbryden.live for tour dates of A Night of Songs and Laughter. If you love the show, do please follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share this with literally everyone you know and a few people you don't as well. Comment, rate us. 5 stars, please. It all helps spread the word so that we can make more of these. Out to Lunch is a Something Else and Jay Rayner production. The music was written, arranged and performed by me, Jay Rayner, and Robert Rickenberg. The recording engineer was Leif Troop and the mix engineer was Gulliver Tickle. Assistant producers are Anya Das and Bethany Hocken. The producer is Selina Ream and the executive producer is Darby Doris. Next time, it's the fabulous actress, writer and comedian Rose Matafeo.
Do you know all the other famous people from New Zealand? Have you met? Here's the key question.
Have you met all of those people?
Rose,
yeah.
Have you met Sam Neill?
I have met Sam Neill!